Right after Christmas, I always breathe a big sigh of relief because for pastors, it's a lot of pressure and work leading up to Christmas. And the day after Christmas, we like to go out to dinner together as a family. You know, we find one of our favorite local restaurants. This year, it was the Rail at Reddington. Does anybody know that place? Yes? Who said yes? They've got good burgers, right? And there's one person up there who likes it too. When we sit at the table, I always ask, I ask everyone to think back in the year behind them and then also to look ahead. And looking back, what are some of the highlights? And then looking ahead, what do you hope for? I know many of you do the same kind of thing. Is that right? Yeah. And of course, I, looking back and then thinking forward, it's impossible for me not to think of Jesus. And I don't mean that just because I'm a pastor. But when I look back, the things that I see that seem good, I always can trace them back to him. And when I look forward, the things that I hope for, he's always folded into those hopes in one way or another. And this is a part of who I am. And so thinking about what's ahead, I thought of what I wanted to share this morning. And it really is very simple. It's what to me is one of the most outstanding things that I recall Jesus having taught. Many of you know the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew's gospel, it's this extended block of Jesus' teaching, which he offered right on the hillside by the Sea of Galilee. A few years back, I went to Israel with some folks from the church, and I can see some of you here. We traveled there together, and maybe you remember there was a day when we went to a church that was built on the site where they believe Jesus offered this teaching, the Sermon on the Mount. It's remarkable to be there because if you've been in church and you've heard these passages read, you might imagine that this is sort of another world kind of place where this happened, but you can stand on the same ground where Jesus stood and gathered crowds around him when he taught. And when we were there, I found myself going into my imagination, remembering the words that I know and treasure from this section of teaching. And there's one bit in the center, which has always stood out to me more than any other. And in a way, it captures the things that I'm grateful for in the year behind me. And it also captures and wraps up the ambitions for what I hope for in the year ahead. And it's a saying of his that you might know that's known by the phrase, the golden, there you go, rule. I'm just testing you. The golden rule. You know it? Here's how it's recorded in Matthew chapter 7, verse 12. In everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. This is the law and the prophets. In a very concise and manageable way, Jesus offers a summary statement of his ethics, a rule for how to live a meaningful life. And for me, when I look back, the things that stand out are things which conform to this way. And a compass to guide you in what's ahead. And when I think ahead and what I want for my actions and my ambitions to be governed by in not just some things, but as Jesus says, in everything is this rule for how to live. Putting others first and putting me second. You know how revolutionary this idea is because naturally I want to put myself first and others second. Does anyone else in here sense that in themselves? And almost everything that surrounds us and the advertisements that we're bombarded by teach us yourself first, others second. The thing about that way of living, and this is my goal this morning, is to show you that when you do live like that with yourself at the center, it makes life pointless. And it really does. Not immediately. Maybe for a while you can live with yourself first and be okay with it. But the truth about everyone who lives like that is eventually they'll get to the point where they look at their lives and say, I've made a mistake. Either that or they'll decide that life itself is pointless. Maybe they've got it right, but that's just the nature of the world. Now, on the other hand, if we take Jesus' teaching here seriously, And this is what I hope for in the year ahead for me and you too, is that we can be shaken out of our self-focus and find the freedom and the joy that will elude us as long as we put ourselves in the center. We'll come back to Jesus' teaching, but I want to share a story, an old story that I came across about 10 years back that represents the heart of Jesus' teaching and was written by an author who, if you quote this author, you sound smart. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Has anyone read any of Dostoevsky? Yes? All of it? Has anyone pretended to read Dostoevsky? There's a story that's a short story of his, in which the main character of the story is a person who's in crisis, goes through a dramatic transformation, and at the climax of the story, here's what he says. The chief thing is to love others like yourself. That's the chief thing, and that's everything. Nothing else matters. You can see it. The story is entitled The Ridiculous Man. And in the story, that character who said that isn't actually given a name. He's just called the Ridiculous Man. And it's a way for Dostoevsky to point to the irony that this outlook on life will seem ridiculous in the world in which we live. But these are the words of a person who had been completely transformed from someone who, when we first meet him, believes that life is altogether pointless. And then at the end of his story, he comes to believe that nothing matters, nothing at all matters like loving others. When we meet him in the story, it's November 3rd. And he's walking through the rainy streets in the evening, heading back to the apartment where he lives by himself, where every night he sits down in his armchair alone, next to which there is a loaded revolver. He bought the gun a few months earlier at the moment that he decided that life is meaningless. And he put it there next to his armchair because he knew at some point he would follow that belief all the way to its logical end and take his own life. As he walks through the streets, he's overwhelmed by a deep feeling of spite, not toward any one person, but toward the world at large, toward every person. He just has an inner grouchiness that is aimed at everyone. Now, I'll come back to the story in a moment, but I wonder if you've felt that kind of feeling in this year behind you. Have you? For me, I have. And it happens mostly when there are news stories that capture my attention and drag my heart into a direction which says, it feels like the world will always be bleak and gloomy. This rain in my heart, it's what's happening in the world around. You felt it too, haven't you? As he walks along on this particular evening, there's a break in the clouds above through which a single star shines. And he sees it, and in the moment that he sees it, he stops walking and he makes a decision. Somehow, that light inspires him to decide that when he gets home, this will be the night when he finally takes his life. And just then, as he's staring at the heavens, he feels a tugging at his arm. And he looks, and it's a small girl, all alone, 8 years old, drenched in rain, pulling on his sleeve, calling out to him, but he can't hear or understand what she's saying because she's so cold, she's shaking violently enough that she can't actually get the words out. He looks at her and then finally realizes she's pleading with him, but not on her own behalf, on the behalf of her poor mother who's ill at home. The girl is begging for help from him for his mother. His instinct in response to her is to push her away. And that's what he does. He pushes her arm off and says, go, get away from me, go to the police. But she won't move away. She clasps her hands and starts to beg and plead in earnest. Help me, please, I need your help. And then, again, his instincts, they kick in and he stamps his foot and yells at her until he frightens her and she runs off. And then he makes his way back to his apartment. He climbs up the stairs. He sits down in the chair where he knows he's going to do it. But as soon as he sits, he reaches for the revolver but something like an invisible force keeps his hand from taking it. He can't understand why he wants to grab it, but he can't. And as he tries, the thought of that young girl in her need keeps him from being able to take it up. It's like her desperation has suddenly found its way into the center of his heart, so he can't act out against himself in this moment. It's a pretty good story, don't you think? Yeah, Dostoevsky was a good reader. You're going to try to read him after hearing this. It's less dramatic for us, but I bet you would admit that you often find yourself instinctively behaving like that ridiculous man. When you get into your routines, when you keep doing everything like you've always done it, don't you naturally incline toward putting yourself into the center of everything? Would you admit that? I don't want it to be true. I try hard not to put myself in the center, but I have to admit, I do. And if you would be open to seeing how you also do, rather than objecting to this idea that you also can be quite self-centered, then you might learn something and be changed like that ridiculous man is changed. We'll come back to his story in a minute, but let me say to you that you put yourself in the center, and here's one example of perhaps why you can admit it. When you came to church here on Christmas Eve, somebody was sitting in the seat that you always sit in. I know it because I can see you here, and I remember on Christmas Eve thinking, where are they? And was there a part of you that thought, that's my seat? Was there? Yeah, of course there was. And I'm not criticizing you. I'm just wanting you to see this. It's the same in most environments that we find ourselves in, that we instinctively get into our routines and imagine the things that we're used to as if they're ours. Like I'm driving on the road and someone cuts into my lane. But how did I come to own that lane? Or I'm shopping and someone cuts in front of me into my aisle at the supermarket. Same question. What makes me think that it's mine? Now, if you would like to reinforce that instinct in yourself. Okay, now my tongue is in my cheek, you can't tell. But if you would like to reinforce that instinct of self-centeredness, here's how you should do it. Are you ready? First of all, you should make sure that in this week and in this month and in this year ahead of you, you should divide up your time on the basis of what gives you the most pleasure, what causes you the most comfort, the most convenience. If some use of time doesn't actually help you, then don't use your time in that way. It's not worth your time. Your time. Guard every second which is yours. Do you see what I'm doing? Just like the aisle in the supermarket or the lane in the road, maybe it's a mistake for us to think of time as if it's our possession. Maybe it's not. Same with your resources, your income. Think of every dollar that you have as if it's your own personal property. And once you begin to start earning money, think of every single penny as material for your benefit to satisfy your appetites. You earned it. It's yours. Use it for yourself. Ignore every sign that you have more than you need. As soon as you start to think you have more than you need, buy more than you need. Get a bigger house, or if it's not convenient, get a storage unit to put some of the extra stuff that you don't need in. And don't pay any attention to the many people around you who have less than they need. Tell yourself that's someone else's problem. Even if a little poor girl comes tugging on your sleeve in the street. Here, the truth about life is that if you go along life in this way, it will be miserable, no matter how much you succeed. And I'm 100% sure of it. Acquire everything, use everything, find every experience to bring you comfort. If you do that, you will be empty and even more empty with every success. And the reason for that is God, your creator, didn't make you to be in the center. And it is simple. And I don't want to make this message complicated. Let's keep it simple. As long as you put yourself in the center, you'll be miserable. And you'll be ridiculous. Here, let's come back to Jesus' teaching for a bit and dwell on it. The teaching which he gave beside the sea on that hillside with so many gathered. Look at the words again. Matthew 7:12. In everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. For this is the law and the prophets. When he first spoke those words, there were men and women who were in earnest to understand and know what this teacher had to teach them. You are also, I know you are, because here we're gathered together. You're wanting to know what Jesus has to say, and he wanted them to hear the wisdom that he came to give them. And the wisdom wasn't just some good advice from a teacher who was enlightened. It was wisdom that was meant to sum up the will of God himself. And that's what Jesus means at this last phrase. Look at it. The law and the prophets. That was shorthand for how to refer to the will of God the Creator. The people gathered there were many of them religious Jews who had wanted to know who God was, and they studied Torah, the writings, which from their perspective was the revealed will of God who made the world that they inhabited, and they knew and trusted the only way to faithfully find your way in this complex world is to know the will of God and to move forward in the will of God. And so Jesus sums up the law and the prophets in a way that's manageable for them, something that they can grasp and hold onto, not in a classroom, but on a hillside. And listen now, a student of history can discover that Jesus was not the first teacher, the first rabbi, to try to sum up everything in a concise statement. And here's one of the many delightful things that I got to discover as a student in seminary, is how Jesus often was imitating others in the way that he taught. There were other rabbis who were approached by eager students who said, "Can you tell us what everything boils down to?" There are records of other interchanges. There's one in particular, a Gentile who wanted to convert to Judaism, went seeking after the best possible teacher, and one of them said, "Hey, if you can give me a summary of the law and the prophets, while I stand on one foot, I'll convert." And the rabbi that he asked to do this was a guy named Shammai. And you can read this in the history. Shammai happened to be holding like a staff. You know how sometimes you picture like a wise teacher leaning on their staff? Shammai lifted the staff and tried to hit the guy in the head with it. And now, in seminary, we learned you shouldn't do that when people ask questions that you think are foolish. That potential convert didn't give up. He went and found another rabbi, Hillel. Have you heard of Hillel? That's a rabbi who's a bit better known. Hillel's answer, I've actually got it here. Listen to what Hillel says. Here's his response. "What is hateful to you, to your fellow, don't do." That's the entirety of the Torah. Everything else is elaboration. Do you notice how similar it is to Jesus' teaching? On the one hand, just like Jesus, here's a teacher who tries to boil it all down, the entirety of the Torah, everything else is elaboration, and what he comes up with is, in effect, an ethic for how to treat other people. In that regard, it's exactly the same as Jesus, but there is a very distinct difference. And just look at how it begins there. What is hateful to you? This man's ethic is built around the things that you hate, the things that you wish no one would ever do to you. I wonder, would you think for a moment, even though it's uncomfortable, about what some of those things are for you? And they don't have to be big things, they can be petty things. People who know me well would know the first thing that comes to my mind are dirty dishes left next to the sink. Hateful to me. I have to share this. My wife, who is the pastor of children's ministry, is sitting with us this morning, and I know where she's sitting, and I just looked and she went like this. But what is it for you? So this ethic says, imagine those things, don't do those to other people. And it's a pretty good ethic, don't you think? I mean, the world would improve significantly if everyone followed that way of being. But listen now, it doesn't hold a candle to Jesus' ethic, does it? Because his is entirely positive, and this one is 100% negative. It tells you what not to do on the basis of what you hate. Jesus does the opposite. He tells us what we ought to do on the basis of what we deep down inside wish for. Here, look at Jesus' teaching again. It's do to others as you would have them do to you. Do you see how it turns the whole thing upside down? It's not an ethic that requires, first of all, us focusing on the things that we don't like in the world. It's not an ethic that requires us first to stop doing things, but it's proactive based on what is positive. And at its heart, Jesus' ethic turns our natural inclinations inside out. Rather than thinking of what's ours and wanting to hold onto it, it turns it around, thinking of what we instinctively want for ourselves and pushes us to give that to others. So that we use our creative energies to put other people in the center and treat that other person as we wish we were treated, if only we were at the center. And whether it's the person in the car that's cut you off, or in the line at the supermarket, or that guy at the cubicle next to you, or the kid who sits beside you in homeroom, or the hungry people you pass on the way to work, or a little street girl crying out for help, Jesus' ethic invites us into a completely transformed way of being in the world. And it does have the power to take the person who accepts it and turn them all together around. And now back to Dostoevsky's story. That's what actually happens for the ridiculous man. While he's there in his seat trying to grab for his revolver, something happens to him that evening, which hadn't happened for months, not since he bought the gun. And it is that he falls into a deep and peaceful rest. The moment he lets another person matter in his heart more than himself, he's already beginning to change on the inside. And in that rest, something else happens that hadn't happened to him for months, which is he has a dream. And it's a vivid dream. It's so vivid, he can't tell the difference between dream and reality. In Dostoevsky's story, he calls it a vision. And here's the vision. The world that he's in is a world in which Adam and Eve never went to the center of the garden as they weren't supposed to. It's a world in which the fall never happened. And so in his vision, the world is a world where everybody gives the center to other people. And so in that world, instead of one person being in the center, you, along with everybody else living with one person in the center, them. It's a world where all of the people are putting others in the center, so everybody has the center in the hearts of the people around them. And so rather than you just having the center in one heart, you have the center in many hearts. Everyone who knows you puts you in the center. Do you see the difference? And so it's a world that is, in every way, good. Now, when he wakes up from the dream, he does not do what at least one of you cynical people in here is doing, which is to say, oh, it was just a dream. Bah. No, he goes out into the street and he decides, I can be one person who brings that world that I've just envisioned into the world that we live in. And I'm telling you now, all of you, that every one of you can also be a person who brings that kind of paradise into the world that we live in right now, even if only in part, even if just one of you does it, then you will be pursuing the kind of ethic that Jesus spoke on that mountainside, which the ridiculous man awakened to, and which will change your experience of life in the world ahead of you, and which will change the experience for the people that are around you every day. And here I want to end with very practical pastoral guidance. So I don't want to just tell you what could happen, but I want to push you into what I think is a pathway where you're more likely to achieve this. So here it is. First, I want each of you to ask yourself this question honestly. What do I want from other people? So before thinking about what you want to do for others in this year ahead, let yourself acknowledge this question and be honest about it. And I spent time thinking about this. I'll share what I came up with, but it would be wise on your own to spend time asking that question and just be real, be honest. Here's what I wrote. I want help. I want positive attention. I want encouragement when I lose sight of what's what. I want to be included. I want to be understood. I want to be given the benefit of the doubt. I want others to be patient with me. I want someone to take me out to lunch for fast food. I want to be forgiven. I want others to believe in me. I want others to see the best in me and overlook my faults. I want someone who's wiser than I am to give me insights and guidance. I want someone who sees my shortcomings and is willing to help me improve by saying challenging things to me. I want someone who will help me grow as a disciple. I want someone to pay attention to my needs and help me learn how to meet them faithfully. I want a friend who's willing to accept me even as I truly am. I want someone to see the good in me that I don't see in myself, so they can build me up. Now, what do you want? Now, once you have your list, Jesus' guidance is give that to other people. And it's that simple. If I'm going to be a faithful and effective disciple, then that list which I just read you, all I need to do is turn it around from what I want to get from other people into what I'm going to choose to give to other people. And God has made me in such a way that I am capable of applying the energy and the resources that are at my disposal toward these ends. I know that the natural man in me is going to be inclined in another direction. I admit it. And same is true for you. And I know that the world around me is not going to reinforce Jesus' lesson in me. I know that. And so what am I responsible for? It's what you're responsible for. It is to do the best that we can to subject ourselves every day to the will of the Lord Jesus Christ, to be open to the help that he chooses and promises to give to us as we work at obeying him. And then in everything in this year ahead, let our ambitions be to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. Then we will find real life worth living, even if to others we seem to be ridiculous. Let's pray. God, I'm so grateful for this time that you've given us to be with one another. I'm so grateful for the teaching of Jesus on that mountainside. I'm so grateful for the wisdom of authors like Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I'm so thankful for the gift of time, which keeps moving, and we think of that especially at the end of a year, but which also is always filled with opportunities for us to receive your guidance and put it into practice. And so I pray that each and every one of us here would be able to do that with hearts that are open and trusting in you, but also turned toward others and the needs around us. Help us apply the golden rule in this day and in the time ahead of us. I pray for this in Jesus' name. Amen.